When most people hear the name Bin Laden, they think of one guy, a very tall, bearded, bad, most wanted man whom, despite our best efforts, we can't find. But long before Osama imposed himself on the world, the Bin Laden name was well known to many, especially in Saudi Arabia, where the family has a close business relationship with the royal family. Now the story of the Bin Laden clan has been laid out in juicy detail in a new book by Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Steve Call. It's called The Bin Ladens, An Arabian Family in the American Century. And Steve Call joins us now. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Faith. Thanks for having me.
So it's funny because as you get into the Bin Laden saga, Osama's story is really in some ways less interesting than that of the rest of the family, which is this tale of international business, originally the business of building horribly gaudy palaces for Saudi royals.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you read it that way, because that's the way I felt as I was working on it. His more secular brothers and sisters in some ways were more nuanced and complicated and interesting people, even though, as you said at the top, they also had kind of a fringe lifestyle, at least on the far edge of that wing of the family.
When you were researching this, Steve, were you just, the more you uncovered, were you like, this is gold? This is like Judith Krantz novel.
Yeah, I did say quite often to my friends as I was going along that I wasn't sure what kind of book it would be, whether anyone would appreciate it and so on, but I knew that it was the most entertaining thing I'd ever done, and it really was a joy to work on it. Once I encountered in particular Osama's elder brother, Salem, who was this rock and roll adventurer and pilot and kind of wild but charismatic character, I just felt drawn into something that was more and more fantastic at each turn.
There are good stories about Salem that I want to get to. But first, let's talk about the patriarch of the Bin Laden family, Osama's father, Mohammed. He grew up in Yemen in a canyon, very poor, then migrated to Saudi Arabia, where he managed to ingratiate himself with the House of Saud. Will you talk about how he pulled that off?
Well, he just had an intuition about people that was extraordinary, and he made himself useful to the Saudis, even though they were an idiosyncratic group to be working for. So whatever they wanted, he found a way to deliver it. If that meant using his bulldozers to dig their private pool, if it meant that they imported hundreds of cars before they realized they wanted roads, then he was there to say, well, I'll build those roads for you. And he could tolerate late payments. If they wanted to trade a chicken farm for a palace, he figured out a way to make that work. So he was a genius about people more than anything else. He also was a gifted sort of organizer of his own business in a very difficult environment that thwarted a lot of international companies.
You mentioned the cars, and I just want to give people a sense of the numbers. In 1952, the royal family bought 800 vehicles as gifts for friends and family,
right.
And that's
right.
When Mohammed decided.
Remember all those old TV shows, those big Packards and Fords, you know, and you can imagine just driving them across sand until somebody stops and says, you know, it would be a lot better if we had paved roads.
Maybe this is where they get the idea for the Daytona races. Aren't they on the beach?
Well, I think some of them are. But yeah. They also went hunting. They went hunting. The king went hunting in his open Ford, sitting in the front seat with a gun, chasing gazelles. It wasn't really
Aww.
A sport that was otherwise on the global map, but it was one that they invented for a while. But eventually they built roads, or Mohammed bin Laden built roads.
Yeah, so Mohammed is you know, very motivated. Things go great for him. Pretty soon he's motivated in another way, too. He's fathering children throughout the kingdom.
Yes.
54 of them all with different wives, thank God. His eldest son was named Salem, as you mentioned, and he was this international playboy. Talk to me about him.
Well, he was somebody who loved to travel and play, and he sort of purchased this identity with his wealth in the West. To some extent, the sort of familiar Arab playboy of the 70s and 80s, but actually I came to see him as a more likable and complicated person than that cliche. He had a very kind of egalitarian streak. He loved to fly. He loved to play rock and roll. He loved to perform. At any party, he'd buy his way onto this stage and lead the crowd in House of the Rising Sun in Seven Languages or corny folk songs like On Top of Old Smoky. He left behind, I found, a world of people, including many, many Americans, who truly loved him, who truly remembered him as one of the most sort of charismatic and, in many ways, sweet-tempered and fun people they had ever known.
And the ladies loved him as well.
The ladies loved him, yeah, and he loved the ladies, as it happened.
Now, Steve, we've got to talk about Osama, obviously, but will you quickly tell this hemorrhoid surgery story where a Salem showed a slideshow of his hemorrhoidectomy.
Yeah, he had this sort of self-dramatizing streak, might be present in Osama as well, but in his case, he needed hemorrhoid surgery in 1980 or so, and he hired the very best cardiovascular surgeon he could find, even though such expertise isn't generally required for hemorrhoid surgery, and then he photographed the entire operation from the point of view of his backside and arranged a slideshow that he showed to the King of Saudi Arabia and many, many other people to a soundtrack of some sort. And it's sort of hard to explain, but when I was reporting the book, at least 20 people volunteered the story. Oh, have you ever seen the hemorrhoid show?
Yeah, nobody.
But it was the sort of, you know, he was like a kind of prankster in the Saudi court who always violated the decorum of the royal family, but did it in a way that was more entertaining than offensive, and somehow it worked for him.
And, you know, Steve, I think Salim's story demonstrates this major theme of your book and the story of Saudi Arabia, which is how different people from a traditional religious culture respond to wealth and exposure to the West. Like Hassan bin Laden becomes a principal shareholder in the Hard Rock Cafe in the Middle East. And, you know, if the story didn't end so badly, it could be a great sitcom. You know, the Osama Mama's family or 54 yeah. is enough. You, don't stop me. I could go all day. But let's get to the star of the show, I guess, unfortunately. Osama is a boy. You describe him as very shy. He's a mama's boy to his 15-year-old mother.
Yeah, his 15-year-old mother, married to a man three times her age, taken away from her poor family in Syria, then has a son and is then divorced by her husband, who arranges for her remarriage to a middle-level executive in her husband's company. So she now enters into a second marriage, still a teenager, clinging to this young boy, and then turns out to have a sort of monogamous suburban life with this stepfather, Osama's stepfather. They have several children together. But you see Osama growing up in this house, a lot of emotional sort of intensity built into it. He's the golden child. He's the source of their wealth because he's a legitimate heir to Mohammed bin Laden's fortune. He receives hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in dividends. His stepfather, you know, is making a salary, a tiny fraction of that. And somehow in this specialness, he becomes very shy, but also it turns out very ambitious and very sort of full of his own sense of his own potential, which ultimately expresses itself in a very radical way.
You trace his radicalization really to high school. How did that happen? Was he predisposed?
You know, it's a very common thing in the Gulf, in Saudi Arabia and in neighboring countries, where middle-class parents worry about the recruitment of their pre-adolescent, adolescent boys the way American parents might worry about drugs or street gangs or that sort of thing. And he was in a prep school
Steve, you mean recruitment into a radical...
Precisely, into a radical Islamic group.
Okay.
He was recruited by his Syrian gym teacher into what looks like, on the surface, an ordinary religious study group after school, but actually had a very heavy political and revolutionary content because the teacher was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, an anti-colonial Islamist revolutionary movement. Mm-hmm. Hamas is the Muslim Brotherhood, for instance. And its recruitment pattern targets elite boys in adolescence, early adolescence, and indoctrinates them into a political creed. And so Osama came out of that study group at 15, 16, a member of the Brotherhood, young apprentice member. And in some sense, he never really deviated. But it was unusual in Saudi Arabia to have such a political education at such a young age. And it was sort of an accident of the teachers at his prep school that he was drawn into this particular group.
And you give really specific examples of how radical he came, because as he grew into adult, his children weren't allowed to drink through straws because those hadn't existed during the Prophet's time, and even his wives had to be fully veiled at all times. But despite this traditional outlook, he had great respect for his older brother, Salim. You, in fact, suggest that 9/11 may not have happened had Salim been around to stop Osama. Why do you think that?
Well, a lot of Salim's friends made that case to me in the course of the research. It wasn't necessarily an idea I would have come to myself, but they were adamant about it because two things. Salim and Osama worked very closely together during the 1980s, even though they lived very different lives. Salim used to fly up to the Afghan border with his shaggy-haired, chain-smoking pilot friends. Those were the only Americans Osama ever met, were these pilots and rock and roll musicians that tagged along with Salim. And so there was a mutual respect in their relationship that these friends of Salim speculate would have led Salim to successfully reel Osama in. And at the same time, Salim was just a very strong personality. And the hypothesis is that when Osama went off the reservation, Salim would have just done whatever was necessary to bring him back, even if it meant throwing a burlap sack over his head and bringing him home to Saudi Arabia.
Steve, we only have a minute left for such a huge question, but I'll ask it anyway. You know, in retrospect, we see this crucible out of which 9/11 rose. You know, global business, U.S. military bases on Saudi soil, you know, a corrupt oil-rich government and a family that built a business on corruption. And then you have Osama, angry and exiled. Did this inevitably have to lead to catastrophe?
No, but I think you observed the context exactly right. And it's not as if Osama's ideas about declaring war on his family or his country were completely out of the blue or out of context. I mean, he was just another dissenter. What made him change the world was partly his talent. He was a unique talent and a modern figure who was able to innovate and succeed. But also, finally, he was a global he had a global vision of his war. And that, too, I think, is rooted in his family. Al-Qaeda, in the end, wasn't just directed at Saudi Arabia. It was directed at a global idea of revolution. And that's what reached the United States on September 11th.
Finally, Steve, are you working on the screenplay for the Bin Laden yet? It's got to at least be a miniseries on CBS.
I think miniseries sounds exactly right. And our operators are standing by.
Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
You're great, Faith. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Steve Call is a staff writer for The New Yorker and president of the New America Foundation. His new book is called The Bin Ladens, An Arabian Family in the American Century. For more about him, please visit our website, morefairgame.org.